Then your father.
He had been strangely startled to realize that the MC meant him, that he was really the new father. A father. Ahmed's wife, Sike, was hugging him, tugging Buki's cheeks, people milling about, laughter thick in the air's clasp. They admired the new baby, asleep in the crook of her bespectacled grandmother's arms. And it struck Obinze that a few years ago they were attending weddings, now it was christenings, and soon it would be funerals. They would die. They would all die after trudging through lives in which they were neither happy nor unhappy. He tried to shake off the morose shadow that was enveloping him. Kosi took Buki over to the cluster of women and children near the living room entrance. There was some sort of game being played in a circle, at the centre of which was a red-lipped clown. Obinze watched his daughter, her ungainly walk, the blue band speckled with silk flowers that sat on her head of thick hair, the way she looked up imploringly at Kosi, her expression reminding him of his mother. He could not bear the thought of Buki growing up to resent him, to lack something that he should have been for her. But it wasn't whether or not he left Kosi that should matter, it was how often he saw Buki. He would live in Lagos, after all, and he would make sure he saw her as often as he could. Many people grew up without fathers. He himself had, although he had always had the consoling spirit of his father, idealized, frozen in joyful childhood memories. Since Ifemelu came back, he found himself seeking stories of men who had left their marriages and willing the stories to end well. The children more contented with separated parents than with married unhappy parents. But most of the stories were of resentful children who were bitter about divorce, children who had wanted even unhappy parents to remain together. Once, at his club, he had perked up as a young man talked to some friends about his own parents' divorce, how he had felt relieved by it, because their unhappiness had been heavy.
Their marriage just blocked the blessings in our life, and there was parties that they didn't even fight.
Obinze, from the other end of the bar, had said, "Good," drawing strange looks from everyone. He was still watching Kosi and Buki talk to the red-lipped clown when Okudiba arrived.
"The Zed!"
They hugged, thumped backs.
"How was China?" Obinze asked. "These Chinese people, very wily people. You know, the previous idiots in my project had signed a lot of nonsense deals with the Chinese. We wanted to review some of the agreements, but these Chinese, 50 of them, will come to a meeting and bring papers and just tell you, 'Sign here, sign here.' They will weigh you down with negotiation until they have your money and also your wallet."
Okudibe laughed.
"Come, let's go upstairs. I hear that Ahmed packed bottles of Dom Perignon there."
Upstairs in what seemed to be a dining room, the heavy burgundy drapes were drawn, shutting out the daylight, and a bright elaborate chandelier like a wedding cake made of crystals hung down from the middle of the ceiling. Men were seated around the large oak table, which was crowded with bottles of wine and liquor, with dishes of rice and meat and salads. Ahmed was in and out, giving instructions to the server, listening in on conversations and adding a line or two.
"The wealthy don't really care about tribe, but the lower you go, the more tribe matters," Ahmed was saying when Obinze and Okudiba came in.
Obinze liked Ahmed's sardonic nature. Ahmed had leased strategic rooftops in Lagos just as the mobile phone companies were coming in, and now he sublet the rooftops for their base stations and made what he wryly referred to as the only clean, easy money in the country. Obinze shook hands with the men, most of whom he knew, and asked the server, a young woman who had placed a wine glass in front of him, if he could have a Coke instead. Alcohol would sink him deeper into his marsh. He listened to the conversation around him, the joking, the needling, the telling and retelling. Then they began, as he knew they invariably would, to criticize the government. Money stolen, contracts uncompleted, infrastructure left to rot.
"Look, it's very hard to be a clean public official in this country. Everything is set up for you to steal. And the worst part is, people want you to steal. Your relatives want you to steal, your friends want you to steal," Olu said.
He was thin and slouchy, with the easy boastfulness that came with his inherited wealth, his famous surname. Once, he had apparently been offered a ministerial position, and had responded, according to the urban legend,
"But I can't live in Abuja, there's no water, I can't survive without my boats."
Olu had just divorced his wife, Morenika, Kosi's friend from university. He had often badgered Morenika, who was slightly overweight, about losing weight, about keeping him interested by keeping herself fit. During their divorce, she discovered a cache of pornographic pictures on the home computer, all of obese women, arms and bellies in rolls of fat, and she had concluded, and Kosi agreed, that Olu had a spiritual problem.
Why does everything have to be a spiritual problem? The man just has a fetish, Obinze had told Kosi.
Now, he sometimes found himself looking at Olu with curious amusement. You could never tell with people.
The problem is not that public officials steal. The problem is that they steal too much,
Okudiba said.
Look at all these governors. They leave their state and come to Lagos to buy up all the land, and they will not touch it until they leave office. That is why nobody can afford to buy land these days.
It's true. Land speculators are just spoiling prices for everybody, and the speculators are guys in government. We have serious problems in this country,
Ahmed said. But it's not just Nigeria. There are land speculators everywhere in the world, Eze said. Eze was the wealthiest man in the room, an owner of oil wells, and as many of the Nigerian wealthy were, he was free of angst, an obliviously happy man. He collected art, and he told everyone that he collected art. It reminded Obinze of his mother's friend, Auntie Chinelo, a professor of literature who had come back from a short stay at Harvard and told his mother over dinner at their dining table,
"The problem is we have a very backward bourgeoisie in this country. They have money, but they need to become sophisticated. They need to learn about wine."
And his mother had replied mildly,
"There are many different ways to be poor in the world, but increasingly there seems to be one single way to be rich."
Later, after Auntie Chinelo left, his mother said, "How silly. Why should they learn about wine?" It had struck Obinze, they need to learn about wine. And in a way, it had disappointed him too, because he had always liked Auntie Chinelo. He imagined that somebody had told Eze something similar. You need to collect art. You need to learn about art. And so the man had gone after art with the zeal of an invented interest. Every time Obinze saw Eze and heard him talk fumblingly about his collection, he was tempted to tell Eze to give it all away and free himself.
"Land prices are no problem for people like you, Eze,"
Okudiba said. Eze laughed, a laugh of preening agreement. He had taken off his red blazer and hung it on his chair. He teetered in the name of style on dandyism. He always wore primary colours, and his belt buckles were always large and prominent, like buck teeth. From the other end of the table, Mekus was saying,
"Do you know that my driver said he passed Waik, but the other day I told him to write a list and he cannot write at all. He cannot spell boy and cat. Wonderful."
"Speaking of drivers, my friend was telling me the other day that his driver is an economic homosexual, that the man follows men who give him money. Meanwhile, he has a wife and children at home,"
Ahmed said.
"Economic homosexual,"
somebody repeated to loud general laughter. Charlie Bombay seemed particularly amused. He had a rough, scarred face, the kind of man who would be most himself in the middle of a pack of loud men eating peppery meat, drinking beer and watching Arsenal.
"They said you are really quiet today," Okudiba said, now on his fifth glass of champagne.
"Arudikwa."
Obinze shrugged.
"I'm fine, just tired." "But the Zed is always quiet," Mekos said. "He's a gentleman. Is it because he came here to sit with us? The man reads poems and Shakespeare. Correct English man."
Mekos laughed loudly at his own non-joke. At university, he had been brilliant with electronics. He fixed CD players that were considered lost causes, and his was the first personal computer Obinze had ever seen. He graduated and went to America, then came back a short while afterwards, very furtive and very wealthy, from what many said was a massive credit card fraud. His house was studded with CCTV cameras, his security men had automatic guns, and now at the merest mention of America in a conversation he would say,
"You know, I can never enter America after the deal I did there,"
as though to take the sting from the whispers that trailed him.
"Yes, Zed is a serious gentleman," Ahmed said. Can you imagine? Sike was asking me whether I know anybody like the Zed that I can introduce to her sister. I said, you are not looking for somebody like me to marry your sister, and instead you are looking for somebody like the Zed. Imagine who?
No, the Zed is not quiet because he is a gentleman,
Charlie Bombay said, in his slow manner, his thick Igbo accent adding extra syllables to his words. Halfway through a bottle of cognac that he had put territorially in front of him.
It is because he doesn't want anybody to know how much money he has.
They laughed. Obinze had always imagined that Charlie Bombay was a wife-beater. There was no reason for him to. He knew nothing of Charlie Bombay's personal life, had never even seen his wife. Still, every time he saw Charlie Bombay, he imagined him beating his wife with a thick leather belt. He seemed full of violence, this swaggering, powerful man, this godfather who had paid for his state governor's campaign and now had a monopoly on almost every business in that state.
Don't mind this, Ed. He thinks we don't know that he owns half the land in Lekki, Eze said.
Obinze produced an obligatory chuckle. He brought out his phone and quickly sent Ifemelu a text. Please, talk to me.
We haven't met, and Dabo,
the man sitting on the other side of Okudiba said, reaching across to shake Obinze's hand enthusiastically, as though Obinze had just sprung into existence. Obinze enclosed his hand in a half-hearted shake. Charlie Bombay had mentioned his wealth, and suddenly he was interesting to Dabo.
Are you all into oil too? Dabo asked.
No, Obinze said shortly. He had heard snatches of Dabo's conversation earlier, his work in oil consulting, his children in London. Dabo was probably one of those who installed their wife and children in England and then came back to Nigeria to chase money.
I was just saying that the Nigerians who keep complaining about the oil companies don't understand that this economy will collapse without them, Dabo said.
You must be very confused if you think the oil companies are doing us a favor,
Obinze said. Okudiba gave him an astonished look. The coldness of his tone was out of character.
The Nigerian government basically finances the oil industry with cash calls, and the big oils are planning to withdraw from onshore operations anyway. They want to leave that to the Chinese and focus on offshore operations only. It's like a parallel economy. They keep offshore, only invest in high-tech equipment, pump oil from thousands of kilometers deep, no local crew. Oil workers flown in from Houston and Scotland. So no, they are not doing us a favor.
Yes, Mekus said. And they are all common riffraff. All those underwater plumbers and deep-sea divers and people who know how to repair maintenance robots underwater. Common riffraff, all of them. You see them in the British Airways lounge. They have been on the rig for 1 month with no alcohol, and by the time they get to the airport, they are already stinking drunk, and they make fools of themselves on the flight. My cousin used to be a flight attendant, and she said that it got to a point that the airlines had to make these men sign agreements about drinking, otherwise they wouldn't let them fly.
But the Zed doesn't fly British Airways, so he wouldn't know, Ahmed said.
He had once laughed at Obinze's refusal to fly British Airways, because it was, after all, what the big boys flew.
When I was a regular man in economy, British Airways treated me like shit from a bad diarrhea,
Obinze said. The man laughed. Obinze was hoping his phone would vibrate, and chafing under his hope. He got up.
I need to find the toilet.
It's just straight down, Mekos said.
Okudiba followed him out.
I'm going home, Obinze said. Let me find Kusi and Buki.
The Zed, Ogini? What is it? Is it just tiredness?
They were standing by the curving staircase, hemmed by an ornate balustrade.
You know Ifemelu is back,
Obinze said, and just saying her name warmed him.
I know. Okudiba meant that he knew more. He's serious. I want to marry her.
Have you become a Muslim without telling us?
Oku, I'm not joking. I should never have married Kosi. I knew it even then.
Okudiba took a deep breath and exhaled, as though to brush aside the alcohol.
Look, the Zed, many of us didn't marry the woman we truly loved.
We married the woman that was around when we were ready to marry. So forget this thing. You can keep seeing her, but no need for this kind of white people behavior. If your wife has a child for somebody else or if you beat her, that is a reason for divorce. But to get up and say you have no problem with your wife but you are leaving for another woman, haba, we don't behave like that, please.
Kosi and Buki were standing at the bottom of the stairs. Buki was crying. She fell, Kosi said. She said Daddy must carry her.
Obinze began to descend the stairs.
Book, book, what happened?
Before he got to her, she already had her arms outstretched, waiting for him. Chapter 55. One day, Ifemelu saw the male peacock dance. Its feathers fanned out in a giant halo. The female stood by, pecking at something on the ground, and then, after a while, it walked away, indifferent to the male's great flare of feathers. The male seemed suddenly to totter, perhaps from the weight of its feathers, or from the weight of rejection. Ifemelu took a picture for her blog. She wondered what Obinze would think of it. She remembered how he had asked if she had ever seen the male dance. Memories of him so easily invaded her mind. She would, in the middle of a meeting at an advertising agency, remember Obinze pulling out an ingrown hair on her chin with tweezers, her face up on a pillow, and him very close and very keen in examination. Each memory stunned her with its blinding luminosity. Each brought with it a sense of unassailable loss, a great burden hurtling towards her, and she wished she could duck, lower herself so that it would bypass her, so that she would save herself. Love was a kind of grief. This was what the novelists meant by suffering. She had often thought it a little silly, the idea of suffering for love, but now she understood. She carefully avoided the street in Victoria Island where his club was, and she no longer shopped at the Palms, and she imagined him too avoiding her part of Ikoyi, keeping away from Jazz Hole. She had not run into him anywhere. At first, she played Yori Yori in Obimo, endlessly, and then she stopped, because the songs brought to her memories a finality, as though they were dirges. She was wounded by the half-heartedness in his texting and calling, the limpness of his efforts. He loved her, she knew, but he lacked a certain strength. His backbone was softened by duty. When she put up the post, written after a visit to Rani Nudo's office, about the government's demolishing of hawkers' shacks, an anonymous commenter wrote, "This is like poetry." And she knew it was him. She just knew. It is morning. A truck, a government truck, stops near the tall office building, beside the hawkers' shacks, and men spill out. Men hitting and destroying and levelling and trampling. They destroy the shacks, reduce them to flat pieces of wood. They are doing their job, wearing demolish like crisp business suits. They themselves eat in shacks like these, and if all the shacks like these disappeared in Lagos, they would go lunchless, unable to afford anything else. But they are smashing, trampling, hitting. One of them slaps a woman, because she does not grab her pot and her wares and run. She stands there and tries to talk to them. Later, her face is burning from the slap as she watches her biscuits buried in dust. Her eyes trace a line towards the bleak sky. She does not know yet what she will do, but she will do something. She will regroup and recoup, and go somewhere else and sell her beans and rice and spaghetti, cooked to a near mush, her coke and sweets and biscuits. It is evening. Outside the tall office building, daylight is fading, and the staff buses are waiting. Women walk up to them, wearing flat slippers and telling slow stories of no consequence. Their high-heeled shoes are in their bags. From one woman's unzipped bag, a heel sticks out like a dull dagger. The men walk more quickly to the buses. They walk under a cluster of trees which only hours ago housed the livelihoods of food hawkers. There, drivers and messengers bought their lunch, but now the shacks are gone. They are erased, and nothing is left. Not a stray biscuit wrapper, not a bottle that once held water. Nothing to suggest that they were once there.
Ranyinudo urged her often to go out more, to date.
Obinze always felt a little too cool with himself anyway,
Ranyinudo said, and although Ifemelu knew Ranyinudo was only trying to make her feel better, it still startled her that everyone else did not think Obinze as near perfect as she did. She wrote her blog posts, wondering what he would make of them. She wrote of a fashion show she had attended, how the model had twirled around in an Ankara skirt, a vibrant swish of blues and greens, looking like a haughty butterfly. She wrote of the woman at the street corner in Victoria Island, who joyously said, "Fine, auntie," when Ifemelu stopped to buy apples and oranges. She wrote about the views from her bedroom window. A white egret drooped on the compound wall, exhausted from heat, the gateman helping a hawker raise her tray to her head, an act so full of grace that she stood watching long after the hawker had walked away. She wrote about the announcers on radio stations with their accents so fake and so funny. She wrote about the tendency of Nigerian women to give advice, sincere advice, dense with sanctimony. She wrote about the waterlogged neighborhood, crammed with zinc houses, their roofs like squashed hats, and of the young women who lived there, fashionable and savvy in tight jeans, their lives speckled stubbornly with hope. They wanted to open hair salons, to go to university. They believed their turn would come. "We are just one step away from this life in Islam, all of us who live air-conditioned middle-class lives," she wrote, and wondered if Obinze would agree. The pain of his absence did not decrease with time. It seemed instead to sink in deeper each day, to rouse in her even clearer memories. Still, she was at peace. To be home, to be writing her blog, to have discovered Lagos again. She had, finally, spun herself fully into being. She was reaching back to her past. She called Blaine to say hello, to tell him she had always thought he was too good, too pure for her. And he was stilted over the phone, as though resentful of her call. But at the end he said, "I'm glad you called." She called Kurt, and he sounded upbeat, thrilled to hear from her. And she imagined getting back together, being in a relationship free of depth and pain. "Was it you? Those large amounts of money I used to get for the blog?" she asked. "No," he said, and she wasn't sure whether to believe him or not. "So, you still blogging?"
"Yes."
"About race?"
"No, just about life. Race doesn't really work here. I feel like I got off the plane in Lagos and stopped being black."
"I bet."
She had forgotten how very American he sounded.
"It's not been the same with anybody else," he said.
She liked hearing that. He called her late at night, Nigerian time, and they talked about what they used to do together. The memories seemed burnished now. He made vague references to visiting her in Lagos, and she made vague sounds of assent. One evening, while she was walking into Terra Culture to see a play with Ranyinudo and Zimaye, she ran into Fred. They all sat in the restaurant afterwards, drinking smoothies.
"Nice guy," Ranyinudo whispered to Ifemelu.
At first, Fred talked as before about music and art, his spirit knotted up with the need to impress.
"I'd like to know what you're like when you're not performing," Ifemelu said.
He laughed.
"If you go out with me, you'll know."
There was a silence. Ranyinudo and Zimaye looking at Ifemelu expectantly, and it amused her. "I'll go out with you," she said. He took her to a nightclub, and when she said she was bored by the too loud music, and the smoke, and the barely clothed bodies of strangers too close to hers, he told her sheepishly that he too disliked nightclubs. He had assumed she liked them. They watched films together in her flat, and then in his house in Onuru, where arch paintings hung on his wall. It surprised her that they liked the same films. His cook, an elegant man from Cotonou, made a groundnut stew that she loved. Fred played the guitar for her and sang, his voice husky, and told her how his dream was to be a lead singer in a folksy band. He was attractive, the kind of attractiveness that grew on you. She liked him. He reached out often to push his glasses up, a small push with his finger,
and she thought this endearing. As they lay naked on her bed, all pleasant and all warm, she wished it were different. If only she could feel what she wanted to feel. And then, on a languorous Sunday evening, 7 months since she had last seen him, there Obinze was, at the door of her flat. She stared at him.
"Ifem,"
he said. It was such a surprise to see him, his shaved bald head, and the beautiful gentleness of his face. His eyes were urgent, intense, and she could see the up-down chest movement of his heavy breathing. He was holding a long sheet of paper, dense with writing.
"I've written this for you. It's what I would like to know if I were you, where my mind has been. I've written everything."
He was holding out the paper, his chest still heaving, and she stood there not reaching out for the paper.
"I know we could accept the things we can't be for each other, and even turn it into the poetic tragedy of our lives. Or we could act. I want to act. I want this to happen. Kosi is a good woman, and my marriage was a kind of floating along contentment. But I should never have married her. I always knew that something was missing. I want to raise Buki. I want to see her every day. But I've been pretending all these months. And one day she'll be old enough to know I'm pretending. I moved out of the house today. I'll stay in my flat in Parkview for now, and I hope to see Buki every day if I can. I know it's taken me too long, and I know you're moving on, and I completely understand if you are ambivalent and need time."
He paused. Shifted.
"Ifem, I'm chasing you. I'm going to chase you until you give this a chance."
For a long time, she stared at him. He was saying what she wanted to hear, and yet she stared at him.
"Ceiling,"
she said finally. "Come in."
The End. You've been listening to Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, narrated by Ajua Ando.
Want to find out more about Whole Story audiobooks? Visit us at www.wholestoryaudio.co.uk. Here you'll find hundreds of best-selling titles, together with sound clips, narrator profiles, author interviews, and much more. Alternatively, contact us using the details on the cover to receive updates on new releases. Whole Story Audiobooks. The whole story as the author intended.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.